the million people that receive felony convictions every year don't know that they're signing their life off to collateral consequences when they sign the plea agreement. You know, almost all, I think it's like 98% of criminal convictions are a result of a plea agreement. So you take a plea deal,
right.
The district attorney comes to you and say, "Hey Jay, you robbed somebody with a gun. We're going to offer you 7 years with eight months and 2 strikes. Here's what the consequences are. You do this time, you do 3 years on parole, you pay your fines and fees, sign the deal. I sign the deal. Courts are not required to tell me about the collateral consequences when I get out. So I didn't know that I was signing my life off to collateral consequences. Some of these collateral consequences, like, you know, it's been 10 years since I got out of prison, 20 years since I committed a crime, right? I have 2 young kids. I can't coach their little league team. I can't volunteer at their school. Me and my wife can never adopt kids. I can't work in healthcare, can't work in finance, can't work in government, can't work in education, can't get a lot of professional licenses, like, you know, I'm cutting hair or working in insurance or working in a hospital or becoming a nurse, becoming a lawyer. And so a lot of if you think of, you know, life as a series of, like, the American economy as a series of doors, right? A lot of those doors are locked off to me.
When a child does something wrong, we allocate a consequence to that action, and then they pay their penance, and then all is forgiven. They move on. We learn, they learn, and life is great. As an adult, once you commit a crime, is it so that once you do the time, you get to start over? Not so. We're going to learn a lot more about that here in this TCast. This gentleman did commit a crime, a serious crime, and he did his time, serious time, did his parole time, and then once he had paid his penance in full, was limited to a quarter of the options that most of us other free people experience. And moreover, he's now mature because he's grown since his time of committing such a crime that he committed as a teenager. How much weight do we really put on this consequence? Should it be an eternal consequence? Or should there be some kind of justification on lowering the terms that we extend that consequence into society? And from a society standpoint, at what point can we entrust these people who have committed a serious crime and done their time to do the things that we all trust others to do? We're going to learn a lot about that here with Jay Jordan on this TCast, who's the vice president for the Alliance on Safety and Justice, and along with Nipsey Hussle, co-founded Time Done. This guy's got some really important messages to share, really incredible perspectives. I'm excited for you to listen to it. Scope it out. Jay Jordan on the TCast. First of all, I really appreciate you being here. It means a lot that you would jump on here. Your story is a success story, but every success story is usually preceded by some kind of trough, right? Ebbs and flows of life. And I thought I would start with asking you about your experience that launched what type of career and endeavors that you have now, which had to do with some activity that led you into prison for, what, 7 years or so? And I thought we would start there, even though it's not a great place to start. It'd be a better place to launch from.
Yeah. So that is, it's always a good place to start. Like, I believe movies should always start with the death of the superhero, because then we're like expecting it. You know what I mean? Listen, tell me something, right? Yeah. Like, it is always the best movies where it's like, the superheroes laying down like this, and you're like, okay, he died at the end. She died at the end. It's great. Yeah. Now I know I don't have to expect the climax. So you're waiting for it to happen. So anticipation. I love it. Like, yes, right. I was in prison. Fast forward. All right. So, fresh out of high school, I was involved with a robbery. I was like one of 4 people. I was the only one that did time. Didn't didn't tell anybody. They gave me a lot of times I didn't tell. They gave me 7 years. I should only got like 5 years. They gave me 7 years with two strikes.
So okay.
They made sure I would not come back. And if I did, it was going to be for an extended stay.
So that's already a loaded part of an explanation you're already given here, because you're already saying two strikes, but this is one offense, right?
Yeah.
But yeah. Were there two different types of offenses included in the same episode here, or what? How'd that end up being two strikes?
They gave me a strike for the robbery. Get this. So they gave me a strike for the robbery, and then they gave, because I had a gun, they gave me a strike for the gun. It was like robbery with a gun, and then give you some extra years for the gun and extra years for the robbery because he had a robbery with a gun. So I got charged like 5 times for the robbery with a gun. So that's how California works, right?
Yeah.
And I did 7 years, 7 months, about 90 months out of 92 months. I remember halfway into my prison sentence, I ended up going to solitary confinement.
Oh, wow.
For 2 years.
What?
And so I was in a hole for 2 years. And then that's when I started my business plan to launch a vending machine company. So I was like,
brilliant.
I was in a box, man. Like, yo, I want to sell chips and Sprite.
the stuff you couldn't snatch from the commissary.
I had a lingering sensation that when I got out, it was going to be hard for me to find a job. So I actually, when I got out the solitary confinement, I bought three while I was still in prison. With the help of my sister and my dad, and my family had some places where I can put them. Then when I got out of prison, I just literally couldn't find a job nowhere. Like, no one would hire me. And I looked. I tried to cut hair. I tried to sell insurance, sell real estate, tried to work at grocery stores, gas stations, clothing stores, everywhere. They were like, nope. Yeah. I finally got a job at a temp agency. And the only reason I got the job was because the lady said, listen, the reason you're not getting jobs is because you're telling the truth. Don't tell them you have a felony. I'm like, all right, whatever.
Gosh.
So like, I didn't tell them and I got a job. And I'm like, oh, so you have to be dishonest to get a job? But they put me in the Trader Joe's warehouse on like Arch Road in Stockton. Now, Arch Road is like way, I'm from the north side of Stockton. Arch Road is like way by the airport. And yes, if you guys are listening, Stockton, California does have its own airport, contrary to popular belief. And so it's way by the airport and it's in the freezer. Listen, man, I come from, you know, my ancestors were not freezer people. They didn't come from the mountains, man. We come from the desert.
Tilling new ground here.
Yeah, right. So I was like, yo, this is not cool. And surprisingly, like everybody that worked there either had a felony or was undocumented, because we all were like, you know, our legal status was all jacked up, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we all knew. We never talked about it, but we all knew. But I ended up quitting because I was getting paid like $11 an hour. You know, it was horrible working conditions. And at that time, I had wanted to like really get involved with the community because Stockton was going through a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. And then that was the year that Stockton was voting to go bankrupt. And it was just a lot of my friends were getting murdered. And I was like, listen, man, I don't want to just be working in the Trader Joe's warehouse. And well, shout out to Trader Joe's, by the way. Like I don't want to put them down. Like Trader Joe's gave me my first start when I got out. Shout out to Trader Joe's. Your food is great. Healthy options. You know,
freezing cold, endorsement deal. Frozen food.
Yeah, give me an endorsement deal. Trader Joe's. I ended up leaving that job. And I wanted to do something with kids. I wanted to like mentor kids and really teach them about what I didn't know, which was civics. They took civics out of class. Like that, you know, they weren't teaching kids how like money works. How does the city work? Like what does city budgets, like who pays for parks, or, you know, when you call the fire department, like what does that mean? So yeah. I was like, you know, if I knew that when I was growing up, I would have a better sense of where I stood at in the world.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that was my bright idea.
Yeah. Sounds familiar. I mean, it's still an ongoing issue, right? With the education system kind of prepping you for real life, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I did that, but I had to sell my business. Now I got really good at selling Sprite. and Twix and stuff. So I grew my business to from three or four to 104 machines.
Oh wow.
In three counties. I got really good. So I sold that to my business partner and because I wanted to start this organization. And we did, and it was great. It lasted for like 18 months because I didn't understand that I wasn't supposed to put all my money up. I thought that, you know, I thought that's how you run an organization, with like just pay for everything. So I was like, these high schoolers are like, we want to take a bus to the state capitol. I'm like, you want a bus? You get a bus. So I had a big old bus. Like literally I bust them up twice to the state capitol, like 10 grand a piece. I didn't understand that, you know, $100,000 go quick.
Oh yeah.
When you're doing a program and, but all of them graduated high school. I mean, we were named American Red Cross Hero of the Year in 2014. We got awarded over like 30 times by different organizations, different public officials. It was great. And then I landed a job after that when everybody graduated and I was broke. I was like, you know, I was super famous, you know, in the newspaper, and everyone knew me around town for like this community guy, but no one knew that I was struggling because, you know, I remember I used to, on my LinkedIn, I have this picture where I had like these shoes on, and the shoes have holes on the bottom, and I had, you know, they were like dress shoes, but I had athletic socks on, and my friends made fun of me. You know what I mean? I had like cigarette burns and one button off the button. It was like a thrift store stuff. They were making fun of me, but I was like, I thought I was a smooth criminal. You know what I mean? And I was just wanted to make a difference, you know? And so when that ended, I ended up landing the job as a field director for a congressional campaign. Shout out to Jerry McNerney, Congressman Jerry McNerney, CD9, gave me my first shot at like campaigning. So, and he saw that I had like a lot of support from the community. So I guess he figured that would translate, you know?
Okay.
And that was my question. And I was still on parole. I was like literally on parole running a congressional race. And I remember when Francois Jannard, shout out to Francois too, his campaign manager, he calls me and he's like, hey man, you want to run a campaign? I'm like, you know, I'm on parole, right? He's like, I don't care. I'm like, wait a minute. He said, so you want a parole leader? Like, all right, well, whatever. So I got that gig and we won. We kicked butt. We kicked Tony Amador. Shout out to Tony Amador too. Gave me my first win.
on purpose.
A lot of shout outs.
Concession.
So after we won, I couldn't get a job again. I couldn't find a job and I ended up moving to Los Angeles. I was off parole and I was sleeping in my car for like 3 months. I couldn't find a job.
Yeah. So help us understand a little bit about, I mean, we kind of whipped through a lot of stuff here, so I want the listeners to understand exactly why it's hard to get a job. I mean, specifics, because I mean, we're talking just a lot of people that just don't understand or haven't been in and out of prison or understand the system, how it works, or how it's disparate against people with felonies. And you in particular, with a violent felony, I mean, there's a lot to talk about there because you're also, you know, wanting people to, I mean, the fact is you were given a punishment and you served your time and then your time ended and then you should be starting anew, right? But that's the way people think.
Not so much, right? Yeah, so there's something called collateral consequences. These are actual laws, right? So you have direct consequences, then you have collateral consequences. So say if you have a straight line, think of a straight line, and in the middle of the line there is a straight horizontal line. In the middle of the line, there's, you know, release. Like we get off, like when people get out, when they parole to the streets. And then on the left side is the direct consequences. So you get like the direct consequences of having a criminal record or a felony conviction is like, you know, serving time in jail or prison, paying your fines or fees or restitution, you know, and losing like your civil liberty, like, you know, your right to walk around freely, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately following your release, right on the other side of the line, there's something called collateral consequences. And this is a legal term. These collateral consequences are not the direct consequences, but they're the collateral consequences of having a criminal conviction. And these things, there are about 40,000 of them, 40,000 collateral consequences. And they're economic, civil, and social sanctions that really don't take effect until after you complete your sentence, right? And so and these things are like, you know, they're 40,000. They're actually laws, so like civil codes, education codes. You know, every state has, you know, hundreds of them. Some states like California, they have thousands of them. You know, when you think about like, oh, a person getting their record expunged or getting your record sealed or getting a governor's pardon, those are remedies that get rid of some of these collateral consequences, but there is no complete remedy to completely get rid of all these collateral consequences. In California, you know, the DOJ, the Department of Justice, they keep criminal records until a person turns 99 years old, right? And so even if you get your record expunged or a pardon, you still, you know, face these collateral consequences.
And it's hard to get an expungement that actually stretches across all of those databases and stuff too.
Yeah. There's that's not what an expungement is. An expungement is a court proceeding that sets aside your criminal record and, you know, doesn't allow certain entities to see the record, right? But expungement means different things in different states. Right. In California, that's what an expungement means. In Illinois, an expungement means a complete erasure of the record. But, you know, no one can actually get an expungement in Illinois because the law says you have to be proven innocent to get an expungement. Right. So there's truly no way to get rid of a criminal record. And so there's truly no way to get rid of these 40,000 economic, social and civil sanctions. One of the main events that happened in America that really was the proliferation of these collateral consequences was ironically 9/11. Pre 9/11, less than 50% of employers and less than 50% of landlords did background checks. Post 9/11, upwards of 90% on both sides, landlords and employers, begin to do background checks. In 2003, 2004, you saw the creation of the Professional Background Screeners Association, which was like the industry came to be after 9/11. And so, you know, the million people that receive felony convictions every year don't know that they're signing their life off to collateral consequences when they sign the plea agreement. You know, almost all, I think it's like 98%. Of criminal convictions are a result of a plea agreement. So you take a plea deal,
right?
The district attorney comes to you and say, "Hey Jay, you robbed somebody with a gun. We're going to offer you 7 years with eight months and two strikes. Here's what the consequences are. You do this time. You do 3 years on parole. You pay your fines and fees. Sign the deal." I sign the deal. Courts are not required to tell me about the collateral consequences when I get out. So I didn't know that I was signing my life off to collateral consequences. Some of these collateral consequences, like, you know, it's been 10 years since I got out of prison, 20 years since I committed a crime, right? I have two young kids. I can't coach their little league team. I can't volunteer at their school. Me and my wife can never adopt kids. I can't work in healthcare, can't work in finance, can't work in government, can't work in education, can't get a lot of professional licenses, like, you know, I'm cutting hair, or working in insurance, or working in a hospital, or becoming a nurse, becoming a lawyer. And so a lot of the, if you think of, you know, life as a series of, like the American economy as a series of doors, right? A lot of those doors are locked off to me for the rest of my life.
And how many, like, of those, I'm sorry, there's so many of those that are legal consequences. And, you know, my first impression would have been that so many are just biased consequences from, you know, businesses that have an across the board rule or whatever that isn't really a legal ramification, but you're talking about thousands and thousands of actual legal processes that will prohibit you from being able to take those steps. It's amazing.
Yeah. These live in your state penal codes, your state civil codes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, look, I'm a big proponent of, like, fairness and public safety, right? And so I understand when a person first gets out, right? It's like, okay, this person, you know, are they gonna, you know, hit somebody over the head? Are they gonna steal something? Okay, cool. But how long do we wait until you know, a person doesn't do that anymore, right? Is it always like, look, I robbed somebody fresh out of high school, right? It wasn't like I was, you know, I was a chronic criminal. It was episodic. A lot of people, it's episodic crime. It's the criminogenic influences in their neighborhood caused them to act out, right? And it's very like quick. It's like 5 seconds, 10 seconds. The average crime is like less than 5 minutes. And so you're literally judging somebody based on 5 minutes fresh out of high school. And this person is almost 40 or 50 or 60 years old. It's like, just imagine, you know, for those folks who are listening, just imagine, man, like you're the worst 5 minutes while you were in high school or fresh out of high school. And that's being used to determine whether or not you can adopt kids when you're 50.
Yeah. Oh, that's right? Crazy. That's crazy. Yeah. So you pose one of my questions actually yourself, and I'd love to hear your perspective, because having been through that process and struggling through it and doing the things that we'll talk about here to hedge against some of those consequences, as a business owner, how long do you wait, and what is reasonable? Because you and I both know there are people like you who get out and set their life on the straight and narrow and figure out how to succeed, because they'll be damned if they don't succeed. That's what they're going to do, and they're going to do it righteously. And there are the other ones that are part of part of the recidivism, which is a whole kind of another podcast in of itself. I recognize, because recidivism is not always a result of the individual. I know that, but there's still some of those individuals that I'm sure you serve time with that you wouldn't want to hire in your own business. How does average Joe make that discernment? If average Joe business owner, they have, I don't know, 40 employees and they want to hire somebody to come on and make $20 an hour. Like, how do you make that decision about risking the other work environment and the clients that they serve? At what point can you get that going? I mean, everybody kind of wants to do the right thing, but it's tough for somebody that doesn't have experience in that realm to make that decision. What do you suggest about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not fair for business owners. It's not fair for educators. It's not fair for, you know, people who are just trying to figure out their workforce. The fact of the matter is, for business owners, you know, some of their insurance premiums can go up, right? You know, and it makes it hard for them to get payroll insurance. I mean, look, you know, when you look at the vast majority of like the pervasiveness of the problem, we're talking about 70 to 80 million Americans here. 70 to 80 million Americans have a criminal record. That's twice the size of Canada. Twice the size of the entire population of Canada. Get this, like, this crazy stat. If everybody with a criminal record would hold hands side by side, we could wrap around the earth twice.
Wow.
Right? Like, literally, it's a lot of people. Yeah. The reason I say that is because, you know, it's not fair to all of the hardworking men and women who are small business owners that just are trying to, you know, make a living, to have to make the determination if this person legally should be able to work for them. You know, we created these laws. The legal system, you know, basically said, okay, you know, this person is, you know, broke the law, and we're going to send them to the reformatory. We're going to send them to the rehabilitative center, right? And then they get out. And, you know, these laws in these books, like, these law books don't tell people when a person is rehabilitated, right? And so it's like, it should be on the legal system to tell us, like, this person is rehabilitated, right?
Yeah, that would be helpful.
But it doesn't, and it should be an automatic process, you know? It should be like, if a person commits a crime, if they break the law, you automatically get arrested. Like, the cops come looking for you. The system, like, engages, right? Like, you break the law, the system is like, boom. That's when our criminal justice system engages. That's the only time, actually, when it turns on. Like, it doesn't spend any money preventing crime. It just waits for crime to happen. And then it's like, okay, we're ready to go, right?
Especially these days, you call the police, and
you automatically get arrested. You automatically get charged. You automatically get a deal, or you get convicted or go to trial. You automatically get sentenced. You do your time. Then you automatically get released. The only part that's not automated in that process is, well, when can you automatically re-engage in society? You know, when can you reintegrate into the American economy? There's no reintegration process. There's a re-entering process, but then there's no reintegration process. And so all of us out here, me included now, like I'm, you know, I hire and fire people all day long. I have a staff of 70 people, right? They're going to grow to 100 by the end of, you know, quarter two of next year.
Beautiful.
Like how do I know if this system that is doing this to a million people every single year is spitting them out and telling us, oh, y'all deal with it now. Listen, like there should be an automatic process. And then the data, basically all the science, there's this science called desistance research.
Okay.
And it says, when did the person desist committing crimes, right? When does somebody age out of criminology, right?
Right.
And it's essentially at like 1 year, year over year after a person does not commit a crime, the likelihood of recidivating decreases dramatically. When you get to like the 3 or 4 year mark, a person is just as likely to commit a crime as someone that never committed a crime ever in their life,
yeah.
Right? And so if you say 7 years of not committing a crime, I mean, it's safe to say, you know, for the vast majority of crimes outside of like dealing with child molestation or, you know, rape or anything like that, anything that has to do with sex crimes, which are like crimes you have to register for after you get out.
Right.
Most of this stuff, like people aren't committing crimes. And so what does that have to do with them working? And look, if this was like a person like, you know, Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff probably should never be able to work on Wall Street again, right? But he right. should be able to work in a bakery. You know what I mean? He should be able to like work in a farm or like, you know, like what is the guy going to do? You know? And so it's not as nuanced as like, oh, well, people shouldn't be able to do certain things for the rest of their life. But like, it's very clear. And for the most part, a lot of people aren't doing massive Ponzi schemes. Folks are doing things that have to do with like, you know, quality of life crimes. And so for us, the answer is pretty simple, right? It's like, hey, listen, you know, after 7 years, for most crimes, your criminal record goes away like a credit score. You know,
Interesting,
it's just like, you know, if you got your car repoed when you're 18 or 19, that shouldn't stop you from buying a house when you're 40.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So I think that would eliminate a lot of issues as well. I'm in complete agreement. And how would you personally, outside of the legal system, make a determination in this day and age? Because you also need people to step up and step forward and start to engage and give opportunities, right? So until these laws can switch over and give everybody an opportunity, there's still some discernment for people that don't want to put their business at risk. And I guess you're one. So you've got a business with 70 people. I don't know if they're handling money or if they're responsible to go speak to people on your behalf or whatever these companies might do, making sales. How does one take the first step in trying to hire someone that they know is a felon who was a violent felon? What are some things that we can do to try to encourage people to do that under the circumstances if it is a legal action to be taken? You know what I'm saying? Yeah, just on a personal level, just, you know, personally trying to make that decision.
I mean, get back to the basics, man. I mean, take all the legal beagle stuff out of it. Like, look somebody in their eye, you know? Mm-hmm. Before all this, before like the 2000s and or the night, like, you know, you look the man in his eye and you say, hey, man, you know, I got a job. You're going to do the job? Yep. If you don't do the job, I'll fire you. And that's it. Like, you know, like somewhere along the line, we lost that. We lost true human interaction. You know, we didn't got soft, right? And it's like, you know, we got real like, oh no, we don't want to hire that guy. And it's like, all right, give the guy a chance to be your hardest worker, you know? And that's what it takes, is like the merit. It's like basing hiring decisions on the merit of a person's character. You know, how a person shows up, does he look in your eye, does he shake your hand, do they work hard, are they honest, are they consistent, right? Are they honest about what they did? You know, like, hey, man, ask them. People with criminal records, you know, they're not going to shy away. Now, if they're lying about the stuff and they're not telling you what they did, then of course that person needs to, you know, they need to either get over being ashamed, which is a real thing of like people being ashamed because, you know, having a criminal record, there is a lot of shame to it. But like, you know, folks should just, you know, get back to the basics, man, you know? And this whole, like, the whole ban the box movement, I like it and I don't, because there's still not a component to where we're really having an honest conversation around, like, you know, what does a good human mean? You know, and I think a good human means understanding that everybody deserves a second chance, you know, especially if a person like going to your business to work. It's like I robbed somebody, man. I'm not trying to, like, you know, when I was 18, like, I'm not trying to, like, when I'm 35, you know, go and rob a McDonald's.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of it. Yeah, it's mature. It's maturity.
I'm trying to work here. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, folks are trying to work. If someone takes the time out to fill out an application and come to an interview, it's not one big conspiracy to bamboozle somebody. You know what I mean? They're literally trying to help out. And like, you know, you'll probably run into someone that has not been in prison or jail that would, you know, get over on a business owner as opposed to someone who has. Someone who has knows how high the stakes are.
Yeah.
And knows like what's at stake for themselves. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. So yeah, we see plenty of that. And that's why I say it's just hard for a person who doesn't have a deeper understanding about what prison means, what someone's learned from that, and to recognize, I think what you're describing is what I've observed too, which is it's a maturity thing too. I mean, a lot of people get into mischief when they're young because they think they're invincible and they'll try all kinds of stuff. But, you know, you get in your 40s, 50s, and 60s, I mean, you're not trying to play that. And if you serve a decent amount of time and come out and spend time being responsible and can show some kind of track record of responsibility, I am in complete agreement with you. I don't even know if 7 years isn't too long for somebody like that. Because it seems like if you've done that for 1 or 2 years, that would be pretty significant. For somebody that's compelled to get back into the game, they're going to get right back into the game. They're not going to wait 2 years and then try to start getting back into it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, all right. So that kind of sets the tone for, I mean, you've been involved in a lot of different organizations. I know you started climbing the ladder and you'd kind of left off at a point after you'd moved to LA and you started getting into campaigns, but you have a couple orgs that you've started and really knocked out of the park. You want to talk about any of that stuff?
So we did the first 50 when I was in Stockton. That, man, we got so many kids graduated from there and then worked for, when I was still homeless after all of that, and I worked for LA Voice. This is an outfit in South Los Angeles. Well, it was a county organization, and I my region was South Los Angeles, working with crime victims or victims of crime, you know, who were, you know, their kids were shot due to gang violence, and I was working to reduce gang violence in South Los Angeles, and then.
So that must have been an interesting perspective, though, too, having been kind of on both sides of that. You're seeing a lot of that juxtaposed. Mm-hmm. How did that affect you emotionally or intellectually? How did that affect you?
Yeah, I mean, it was so, you know, my dad's old preacher, man. He's an old country preacher, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always knew that one day I'm gonna get back into church. I just didn't think that, you know, it was going to be, you know, in a hell of gang bullets. Right, I was like, I thought it was gonna be the Holy Ghost field. No, we had a good time. It was great. Mainly women, you know, who lost sons, their sons were murdered, and then women whose sons were in life were doing prison time for life, you know, because they murdered somebody. So it was bringing those two perspectives together was powerful. And we started Faith in Action. It was great. It was an asset-based community development strategy where you would knock on a series of doors around in like a geographic area. So like a 1 mile radius or like a half a mile radius, and see what people actually needed. So do case management for every single house.
Wow.
And then not only what people, so you would map the deficits or map the needs, and then you would also map the assets. So in that same conversation, you would be like, well, what do you have? You know, what can you do? And so you would go back and then do a statistical analysis on, or a special analysis on, where were the needs and then where were the assets, and then try to overlay those two things and then have a series of churches be the container for the resources that people needed and also the workplaces for all the people that had the assets. And then the gaps that were still left, you would bring in services, right? And so that was the idea. And we began to do that. And I got poached for an outfit. Yeah. I got poached by the one and only, shout out to Robert Rooks. Robert Rooks is the CEO of Reform Alliance. He runs the nonprofit for Jay-Z and Meek Mill and Robert Kraft and Mike Rubin and Mike Novogratz and Chan Zuckerberg and all those folks.
You know, I haven't heard of any of those people. I don't know who you're talking about, but
so you know who Jay-Z
is. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I'm just kidding. Yeah, he's got some big clients.
Yeah, the only prerequisite is you have to be a billionaire to be on their board. It's insane. Like the whole board is nothing but billionaire. So he came and poached me before he got big time. He came and poached me, and he was like, "Hey, I got a job for you, man. I think you're really, really dope. I've been watching your stories since Stockton. I didn't know anybody was watching me. I only thought the cops were watching me. I didn't know anybody else was watching me." and then he gave me a job as like networks manager or some shit like that. And it was a really good job, right? I mean, he made it up, but like, mm-hmm. cause he just wanted me on board. And I worked my way up, man. I went from networks manager, where I, you know, pulled a coalition of unlikely allies, labor, business, faith, education folks, around like, you know, public safety issues. And then, helped run a the grassroots steering committee for a statewide ballot, which was insane. That was fun. That was a riot. And then I moved up to Second Chances director. We started this program called Second Chances within the organization. And I brought like police chiefs and judges and probation and people who just got out of prison and people who ran organizations that had felonies. And we came up with something called Repairing the Road to Redemption in California. Kind of, you know, how do we, you know, repair the road to redemption? How do we ensure that people do have redemption when they come home?
Yeah, it's a roadmap. You know?
Yeah, and then in 2018, launched what we call Time Done, which is the program that I help run now for the organization I work for. You know, and I launched that with Nipsey Hussle, man. That was dope. It was his last concert at his hometown. We sold out the Greek Theater. We launched it. And it was to raise awareness about the tens of thousands of legal restrictions that people with convictions face long after they serve their sentence.
Yeah.
And also organizing people and then giving folks a space to go to. Because if you have a criminal record, you have nowhere to go. You know, especially if you're not on probation or parole anymore, there's no place for you to like plug into where you can say that that's your home. And so we're building it like, you know, we launched in 2018 and we ran some laws, we passed some bills already. To kind of automate the expungement process in California. So starting it next year, everybody that with a criminal record that did not result in a prison term dating back, will have their records expunged automatically. And this is dating back to 1973. So it's tens of millions of records representing like 5 million people. And so we've done a lot of work. Then I became Time Done state director, and then they made me executive director of the Californians for Safety and Justice, which is the organization that housed that program. And now I'm the VP of the entire damn thing across 10 states. And
that's amazing.
You know, amazing. Yeah. So it's been a hell of a ride. It's been 6 years, man. I would be out 10 years January 19th.
Congratulations in advance. I'll be the first to tell you. And you seem to be charismatic and well-spoken and passionate, so I can see why you would get stolen from business to business. Yeah. What did Nipsey's death do for that business? Did it draw more positive or negative attention to what you guys were trying to accomplish there?
Yeah, so the organization, I mean, we didn't do the the normal thing that people would have done, which was like, oh, let's capitalize on this moment. You know, we waited. We had a lot of we have a lot of content with him. We just waited and we were like, you know, we're going to respect his death, respect the state, respect the brother. He was real, man. Like, he was authentic. Yeah. And so we haven't released a lot of the stuff that we have with him. Like, a lot. We have like one video with him. We did a tribute video. We have a lot of content with him just talking and, you know, and so a lot of people, we show that video to our members. Because something he says was like super powerful. It's like a 30-second video that he's talking about, just you know, the issues. And so we show it to our new members and get them kind of grounded in what this is about.
That's great.
And it's good. Like, so, you know, we didn't capitalize on his death at all. Like, we didn't. It wasn't even a conversation, really.
Yeah. Well, and I certainly didn't mean to imply that you would have tried to, but I was just curious if it organically like pushed the needle one way or the other. But obviously your silence is just all integrity and class, as you're just trying to respect the family and his legacy. But I also think at this point, you know, his legacy could be, you know, you've got quite a torch in your hand too. So I think that could, you know, it's a purposeful, meaningful endeavor that you guys have going. So I think that would be, I'd be certainly interested to see it. And I'm not even one of the people that it could affect, but I would certainly be one of the people that support it.
For sure. Yeah, it was, I mean, the concert itself was crazy. So, you know, when I talk about the 40,000 legal restrictions, right, there's something our brain does that it doesn't allow us to think in big numbers or visualize big numbers. We're like, 40,000, oh, that's good, bud. Okay, great, right? So I was like, well, fuck it, we'll just build a wall. And on the wall, I don't know what the hell I was smoking that night, but I'm like, like, I was like, I got an idea. I was with the team and I'm like, yo, what if we built a wall? They're like, okay, Jay, you know, and this is if for those folks who know me, they know like this is like vintage Jay. It's like, I got this like, wait, yo, I got this idea. So I'm like, yo, what if we built a wall? And on the wall, we wrote all of the legal statutes, all of the collateral consequences, all 40,000 of them.
Whoa.
And they're like, what? I'm like, let's do it. And so at the concert, we constructed this wall. The wall is like 70 feet long by like 30 feet high. And on it, it has all of like the penal code section 405. You may never own a gun again. Penal education code, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? All the way down. And it took us, you know, 2,100 square feet to actually, you know, write them all down and make them legible. That's how big they are. I mean, that's how many they are.
But that's beautiful.
We still have the wall. Like we pulled the wall out in 2019. We pulled the wall out and we blocked off the street in California right in front of the state capitol. Like literally right in front of the state capitol, we blocked off the street and put the wall right in the middle of the street.
Impact. Like, that's awesome.
And like invited like the Sheriff's Association, because, you know, all these law enforcement agencies have like unions. So we invited all the law enforcement unions, the unions of the prison guards. We invited all these people. I'm like, come see this wall. And people like my staff was like, why are you inviting all these cops? I'm like, they need to see this damn wall, man.
Yeah, you got it. Hey, yeah,
they're the ones giving us the felonies.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to touch both sides for the change to happen. Right. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, so it was great. Like we took them on a tour of the wall, and I did the history of the wall, like the history of collateral consequences in America, and they were like, "Wow, I never knew this existed." And we work with a lot of them now. Like a lot of them, like we got a lot of stuff passed in California because of the wall, and so we're gonna reveal the wall again, but it's not gonna be a wall anymore. It's gonna be a cube, so it's gonna be great. We're actually like going to construct some crazy.
Be just cool surrounded stuff with. So what are you going to do when you start knocking these things down? Because you've already made some progress. I know that you've overturned some laws that are prohibitive and everything else. So are you going to make some significant scratches through that wall when you start knocking these down? Because that'd be kind of cool too, to see them go away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, it will take us years. If we were to remove these things one at a time, And so the reason we did Repairing the Road to Redemption was we realized that it's not the actual legal restrictions themselves, it's the criminal record. Why don't we just get rid of that thing? Like, when, like, how long does it take someone to redeem themselves in California? Do we as a country believe in redemption or not? If not, then let's be serious about it. Let's get clear about it. And let's tell people up front, you know, like, hey, man, if you commit a crime, then you're going to be like, you'll do time in prison, but you'll be screwed for life.
Yeah, and this
like,
is it.
Let, and like, let, and like, let people know that at the time they sign their deal.
Yeah.
Because it's not fair to do the old, you know, the old, the bait and switch, like, oh, here, take this 7 years and sign this paper. And they sign it off. Like, oh, I got you for life. It's like, no, that's the legal system. Like, I got you. They're like, no, like, tell people up front, if we don't believe in redemption, when the DA slides that plea bargain sheet across the table, let that be on there.
And let people make
the determination if they want to take that or if they want to take their chance with 12 in the box, right? Don't try to like hide it. If we don't believe in redemption, if we do believe in redemption, we have to get serious about how long does it take for someone to redeem themselves in America. I will tell you, there's a lot of people here that have done some crazy stuff in their college years that they could be easily called a felony. There's a lot of things that we all do on a daily basis that we can, like jaywalking, speeding, all this stuff, if you have a felony, compounds itself, right? And so I just think that we have to get serious about what does redemption mean in this country and then, you know, allow folks to go on with their life in a reasonable, safe, and fair fashion and not, and allow folks to earn their redemption too. People can't even earn their redemption. They can't even like work towards it. They can't like say, look, I've been clean for 10 years. I haven't committed a crime in 20 years or 30 years. It doesn't matter. It's like that. That's not American, man.
Yeah, that's crazy. Deal. Yeah, and I love what you're doing. I think it's going to be really impactful. And so what types of time limit are you getting success at? Where are you seeing the success rate when you say, hey, we're going to automate this thing to where you get 4 years clean record, it falls off? What are you targeting in a lot of these cases?
Yeah, so the... Like, so there's a federal law called FCRA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that's at 7 years where third-party companies cannot report a credit. I mean, third-party companies cannot report a criminal record after 7 years. Okay. But, I mean, you can go and look at somebody's, you know, court case on the court online database and see it yourself. But, like, the federal government recognizes 7 years as, like, the time. We like the data shows 3 years, 3 to 5 years, depending on the age of a person, which has a lot to do with it. So if a person is over 30, it's like 3 years, or 2 years. If you're over 40, it's like 1 year, you know? So people aren't committing any crimes, if you do a year without committing crimes. And so, you know, and again, to the argument of, well, we don't know if these people are committing crimes or not. I mean, it's if a person is over 40 and they serve 7 years, they're not getting out and they're not going to be the cat burglar peeping into your little window. Like, no, they're going to be the guy knocking on your door, trying to get a job, trying to wash your car or something. And so, I mean, you know, we say where we be getting traction at is 3 to 5 years. And mind you, that's after probation or parole. So in like a place like California, like probation or parole, like 3 years, 2 years, in places like, you know, Texas is like 5 year probation. So we're talking about 8 to 10 years here, which is more than enough time. I think it's way too long. I would personally like to see if someone completes their sentence, gets off probation or parole, that's it. This period of probation or parole should be a reintegration period back into the economy. You shouldn't just like, I don't want to spend my taxpayer dollars paying for a probation officer or parole officer. And all they're doing is like, you know, going to somebody's job with a gun and saying, are you doing what you're supposed to be doing and piss testing them? Nah, like help them get a job, help them reintegrate back into society. Like, and then work with the business owner to be like, I'm going to help this person. I'm going to be responsible for this person. Let me know if they fuck up. You know, that's a more effective way to use probation and parole. Probation and parole should be like doing case management. If these people have some mental issues or some drug issues, they should deal with that while they're in prison or jail. You know, what they're going to prison or jail for, just to sit there? Like, nah, like Make them go to, you know, make them go to treatment. Make them go get some training or something. Like, and so, I mean, there's a better way of doing the front end stuff. And then if a person is held accountable while they're serving their time, they should have some way to earn their redemption. And then when they get out, that 3 years of being on supervised release, it should be a reintegration back into the American economy. And once they're reintegrated, let them live their life. You know, it shouldn't be let them live their life, because if they commit another crime, guess what? They're going back, and there's laws around repeat offenders. And so they're going to be dealt with. And so, but for the most case, you know, people don't look crazy ass stat. There are about 70-80 million people with a criminal record, right? 92.8% of people are already out and been out an average of 6 years. So they're not committing
that number.
Like, yeah. 92.8%. So people aren't out. Wow. Like, they're like me. We're mothers, we're fathers, you know, we're uncles. We're just trying to work. We just want to do our part, pay taxes and move on with our life. We want to, we're trying to buy homes. We're doing all this stuff. And these people don't see that. All they see is what they hear on the radio and the news, like somebody killed somebody. And for some reason, every person with a criminal record gets blamed for someone who's committing a crime. It does not make any sense. Like that.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's the thing. Like I would love to see it. But we're getting a lot of traction. We're getting a lot of traction in Illinois, in Michigan, in Ohio, in Arizona, in Texas. People just care about this issue, you know?
Well, they should. I mean, it's a human issue. And I think by getting some of the laws changed and the standards changed, it's almost like what we've seen with the marijuana laws. I mean, how evil marijuana was 15 years ago and how unbelievably dismissive it is at this point. So, and even in Texas, which is going to be the last state that ever converts, you still see that type of thing. So I think part of it is just opening people's minds enough to accept the fact that there is a term that is a reasonable amount of time that somebody can be rehabilitated. And we all want to give people a chance. And that's kind of a figure that once they start getting used to that, I think that 3 to 5 to 7 years could shrink once we see that success rate start to happen and unfold stuff too. So I think it's fantastic what you're doing. Really appreciate it. And so additionally, if you have anything that you would like to share, I want to definitely share links and opportunities for people to get involved or learn more about what you're doing. So send me some stuff, obviously, but do you have any websites or anything that you wanted to pass on for people that just listen to the audio?
Yeah, I mean, go to timedone.org, one word, time done, like you done your time, timedone.org. Or just follow me on social at Mr. J. Jordan. Mr. is spelled all the way out. M-I-S-T-E-R, J. Jordan, J-A-Y-J-O-R-D-A-N. Follow me. I'm always on different platforms. On LinkedIn, it's J. Jordan, J-A-Y Jordan. I'm the guy in a purple suit. And get involved, man. I will say this. If you folks who are wondering how they could get involved, I would say that, you know, think locally, not globally. Look at what's happening in your own community and seeing how, you know, you can weigh in on some of the stuff that's happening in your community. And if you're a business owner, there's a lot of ways that you could, you know, figure out how to become a Fair Chance employer. It's called Fair Chance Employers. There's a bunch of resources out there. I mean, there's even work credits. If you hire someone from a disadvantaged population, you get payroll tax credit up to like $6,000 a year. You know, and so people can actually like benefit from leaning into this conversation, especially if you're a business owner.
That's amazing stuff. And I'm a frequent LA traveler. It's, you know, COVID's kind of jacked with a lot of my travel, but love to come out and visit with you next time we're in and share a sip and catch up some more. But you've been fantastic to share your time and your ideas. I'd love to learn more some other time. But thanks so much for your time, Jay.
All good. Thanks for having me, brother.
Keep on keeping on the golden age caffeine. It's some side wind you're on. Another situation. See the road from the stripes with the lights coming on. Freedom came upon a catastrophic dream. Another dark page to turn. Another situation. They can't have your heart to find. it's another situation.
From